All right, a nice crowd today. Nice to see so many people both online and in person. We're talking about Sila. So Sila in the context of the 10 perfections or 10 paramis. Remember Christina Philman mentioning when she first started to teach, she did a retreat on ethics, on Sila, and hardly anybody signed up. So it's nice to see that there's interest, or at least maybe you're here without realizing what the topic is. But the break's already over. I know Carrie talked about Sila last 2 weeks, I think talking about the kind of ambiguities around some of it. I think that's what she mentioned she would be exploring. And tonight I'd like to take a little different tact and actually start talking a little bit about joy in relationship to ethics. So joy in relationship to ethics. So coming off of the first parami of generosity, ideally that does start to elicit this quality of joy, of appreciation, you know, toward that connection with another person, whether we're offering generosity or receiving that generosity. Now this word joy is interesting in our society, our culture, because so many of our normal sources of joy are conditional, right? They're based on certain conditions, perhaps a certain possession or a certain experience, certain relationship, certain maybe our health being here or not being there. Those kind of qualities of joy, you know, there's nothing wrong with those. It's wonderful to explore those and to enjoy them. And we also have to realize that those are also impermanent. Those are also, by nature, something that changes. Now, what does ethics have to do with joy? You know, why couple those two? And we think about ethics, there's both pleasure and pain with being ethical and also not being ethical, right? So for being unethical, it's often driven by some pursuit of some pleasure. Pleasure perhaps in the short term, I want to fulfill that little need or that wanting, and there's not perhaps the sense of what the long-term effects of that is. Because there's a little bit of pain also as we decide to be ethical. Maybe there's a sense of renouncing something in order to keep ourselves in a more place of virtue or a sense of morality or a sense of ethics, a sense of letting go of something, and maybe a little bit of pain around that. And this is really the quality of renunciation. And yet, there's a much deeper quality of pleasure and pain that arises when we start to live a life that's more ethical. We start to act more and more from that perspective. The Buddha would talk about this in the joy of blamelessness. There's a sutta where it's called debtlessness, debtless. And this sutta, he's talking to a householder, so someone like us who has, you know, obligations, we enjoy pleasure things, we do all kinds of things as a lay person. And how do we still practice in that condition? You know, he's talked about the four parts of the Sangha. There's the monks, there's the nuns, there's the lay women and the lay men. But he held that as a totality of the Sangha. So in this particular sutta, he's talking to a householder, talking about this sense of there's three kinds of bliss that can be attained by a householder in the proper season, the proper occasions. What are these four? Okay, the first one is the bliss of having, of actually acquiring something, the sense of perhaps could be wealth, could be possessions. There's the bliss of making use of that wealth. You're actually, you know, enjoying it, applying it. There's the bliss of debtlessness, being out of debt, being free of obligations in that way. And the final one is the bliss of blamelessness, the bliss of blamelessness. And this is what we're talking about in terms of ethics and Sila. What is this bliss of blamefulness? So in this one, the Buddha talked about that there's blameless in our bodily actions, our verbal actions, and our mental actions. When we actually follow that, when we have that deep sense that, okay, my words are not causing harm. My words are coming from a place of integrity, a place of ethics. When my actions are coming from that same place, that I'm not harming or stealing, killing, all those qualities, when my actions are following through with that. And mental, when my mental internal dialogue, my judgment, my sense of internal narrative is actually aligned with that quality of blamelessness, of non-harm, then we experience bliss. This is the bliss of blamelessness. And this, some of these suttas, he ends with a little verse. And this one is, knowing the bliss of debtlessness and recollecting the bliss of having, enjoying the bliss of wealth, the mortal then sees clearly with discernment, seeing clearly the wise one knows both sides, that these are not worth 1/16th of the bliss of blamelessness. Okay, so what he just said is that these different sources of pleasure, these different sources of bliss, of our material possessions or our wealth, nothing wrong with those. You can really enjoy them. And yet, all those are just 1/16th of the amount of bliss that comes from blamelessness. Right? So that's an interesting statement there. It goes contrary to so much of our lives. You know, we're so much often seeking things. And sometimes ethically, we kind of stray a little bit. You know, we lose our ethics in pursuit of that. Of course, we can pursue those without being unethical, being very ethical in the midst of that. So how do we become blameless? How do we actually integrate that? Now, when you hear this word blameless, it's kind of this sense of someone is outside who can blame us, who can criticize us or say you're not doing this the right way. And this opens up another question, is really what's the inner motivation? What's the motivation for ethical behavior? What's the motivation or the kind of the inner authority or the outer authority that we're following to help us live an ethical life? Who holds us accountable? And is it an internal authority or is it an external authority? You know, what is the edge there? And I think actually both are helpful. Both are very helpful in our lives and our practice. Because if we just have an external authority that's motivating us, that we're trying to follow, we might be acting ethically to avoid punishment, to avoid being blamed, to avoid going to prison, whatever it might be. But that has a potential for it not being fully embodied, because we're kind of looking outside of ourselves to see if I'm being ethical. And if that external authority is missing, if it's not there, then our ethics go out the window. If no one's watching, you know, how are we? I think that's such an interesting question. Like, I like to notice my own mind or my own actions around things. When no one will know the difference, no one will be the wiser at what choice I make. What choice do I make? What choice arises when no one can see, no one's going to notice? How are our actions when no one is looking? And yet, it's also helpful to sometimes reflect on how other people would hold our actions, how other people will perceive us if they knew we were acting in this unethical way. This has the effect of bringing a little energy, especially when we're kind of struggling. It's like just reflecting on if someone who I really valued their opinion of me, I really wanted them to see me in the best light, you know, that brings a little bit more energy, a little bit more willingness. You know, those of us who are parents, who have been parents, you know that it's really important to act as skillfully as you can, right? You can tell your child not to steal, not to lie, but if you're doing that, that's the message that they get. Right? That's the message of affirmation of how they should be. You know, your friends, this power of Sangha, you know, sitting here as you go through these small groups, as you're talking with other people, Notice how you would feel if you had this choice point of being ethical or not ethical, of following a precept or not following a precept. How would it feel if people knew that about you? You know, if we're kind of looking over our shoulders or trying to hide something, there's that kind of pressure, that sense of worry. But if we're ethical, we have nothing to hide. There's a way that we relax in ourselves. You know, so reflecting on that. One of my mentor teachers once shared that when she got a scam call, someone's trying to scam her out of money, she would ask this person, is your mother alive still? And if the person said yes, she would say, what would she think of what you're doing? How would she feel about if she knew that what you're doing? I think those are short calls there. But there's a little bit of that. I'm a friend of mine who's passed away now, but he grew up in a small town, and his mother actually passed away. But he'd be, you know, he's a little bit rambunctious, and the whole town would, you know, say, what would your mother think about what you're doing? You know, so they're all kind of holding that sense of accountability. Of course, this outside external quality, it also has its edge too, because so many of us have been told, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself, you should feel guilty, and that's often a heavy thing that we carry in our hearts, sometimes much more out of proportion than our actual actions, because it's a way that we can use to control children, right, is trying to make them feel ashamed or bad about themselves. And that's not so helpful. You know, I think that's not so helpful. And it's often it's kind of internalized even as we grow up. So this external motivation, this external authority, or just the external mirroring of your actions, you know, we have to have discernment around it. When can we use it in a way that's helpful, that allows us to have more energy to being ethical? And when do we start to use it in a way that adds more shame to us, just to add heaviness and to realize, okay, maybe I need to release that. There's also the internal authority or internal motivation. And this is one of the ones that is so essential to also integrate into our lives, into our practice. Now, if you just have the internal, though, without the external, sometimes we get a little confused. We get a little bit distorted in our thinking. We get our compass gets a little bit off. You start to notice this, how, you know, you can kind of justify things. You can justify, like, it's okay to, like, you know, no one's going to notice if I take that. No one's going to notice if I cheat in this way or say something that's not true. You know, for myself, I notice there's often, and also with other people, when they're kind of on the ethical edge of something, you can talk yourself out of it. You can say, okay, it's okay to do this. They can justify that behavior. But often it feels like there's a lot of verbiage. There's a lot of internal dialogue going on. Well, if I'm being ethical, there's not a lot to say, right? There's a kind of a simplicity. You know, it may not feel good necessarily because I'm giving up maybe short-term pleasure, but there's a sense of kind of connection, a sense of alignment, the sense of integration. And I think learning to recognize that when we feel kind of lined up, it's like if you're putting something together and the holes in for the screw aren't quite lined up, it doesn't fit quite right. But when it lines up, then it just goes in smoothly. It's almost that internal quality that when we're being ethical, there's that inner alignment. It's almost like you can feel this beat into the earth. You can feel that groundedness. You can feel the sense of uprightness. That I'm upright on this earth. You can hold your head up high. Conversely, when you're not being ethical, when you're feeling that edge of maybe pushing on harm or lying or deceit or whatever it might be, you can see how the body wants to kind of cover up. It wants to kind of hide a little bit. We feel a little less grounded. We feel a little bit more unsettled in that awareness. Our meditation practice is such a tremendous aid in this because it gives you this access to being present, being connected in an undistorted way, and also inner sensitivity to what's arising in the body. Because the mind's going to be able to kind of tell you all kinds of things and justifications. The body is much more simple. It's much more clear. I like to use it almost as a litmus test. If I'm contemplating some action, some choice, I just notice what the body is saying in relationship to that. The body feels relaxed, it feels connected, even if there's some sense of maybe apprehension about going against the stream or the expectations, but yet there's a sense of, okay, I'm connected to what's true. I'm connecting to what's kind in this moment. And if I'm not, you know, there's a lot of agitation that comes into the system. I believe Ruth Dennison once said that once you start to practice, you realize you can't get away with anything, right? And I think what she meant by that, it's not that externally we have some kind of way to monitor your thoughts and intentions, but internally, you just know yourself more and more deeply. I mean, think back to when you first started to practice and your relationship to your own inner world. I know for myself, when I started to practice, there are certainly parts of myself which I judged as being acceptable and good, and some parts which I really did not like, that I felt ashamed about, and I wanted to hide or push away. That self-judgment, that sense of shame, embarrassment, all those kind of qualities, right? And as I started to practice, you know, my teacher really encouraged this attitude of just opening to all of it, to see this whole array of being human, and learning to trust this refuge of mindfulness, this refuge of the practice that's willing to just see what's here without flinching, without trying to change it, but just to actually know it. To trust in the very knowing is powerful, is actually transformational. Right? And the more I was able to do that, the more I was able to see, what am I not allowing in this moment? What am I denying in this moment? Then so much of the struggle started to fall away. And with ethical choices, ethical edges that we arise, that arises in our life, we can start to feel that, you know, what's not being seen, what's not being opened to, what's being not allowed in this moment. We become very aware of this internal quality, you know, the body sense. We also start to realize our patterns of mind, our patterns of conditioning, our patterns of neuroses we could talk about, all these different patterns of judging ourselves, judging others, of control. I mean, there's so many different ways we can describe that. But a lot of it boils down to not allowing yourself to be just how you are, that you think you should be something other than what you are. And those patterns, we start to also be aware of how those load up. And remember, mindfulness of the body is one of the foundations, but also mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of that feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Those are all essential parts of mindfulness. So you start to notice when those things load up. I think that's one of the big advantages of being a lay person, being a householder, is that those get elicited in lots of different ways in our life. Right? We have to work. We have to deal with people which aren't so pleasant. We have to learn to navigate this world. We have responsibilities. We have children to raise. We have elderly parents to take care of. We have our own body that's aging and changing, our own minds. And so all these, as those arise, we can see, okay, where am I in that lens of ethics? You know, how does that arise in that? And is that coming from that internal knowing? Is it coming from this external, you know, wanting to feel like people would approve of what I'm doing? And what's interesting, at some point, it becomes less and less tolerable to be unethical. It becomes less and less, you just feel that, because you become more and more sensitive, more and more aware of things, you can feel that when you're harming someone else, you're really harming yourself. Last month, we talked about generosity and the act of offering to someone else and the act of receiving generosity and how those start to blur. Those two distinctions of external generosity and receiving generosity start to blur and change. They realize as I give to someone else, I'm really giving to myself. As someone receives to me, gives to me, I'm also giving back to them. It's the same thing with harm. That as we harm someone else, we're harming ourselves also. You know, as they give harm to us, they're getting harm to themselves. Right? So this is that sense of harm. How does that arise? How can we become more and more aware and sensitive to that? If we look at the Eightfold Path, the second fold of that, the one that goes right before the action section of the Eightfold Path, is wise intention. Wise intention. And this is one of the things we start to also notice. What's our intention that precedes our action? What's really the intention that's leading to that particular way of speaking in this moment, of using my body, of using my mind? What's the intention that precedes that? And how is that connected to our wisdom? Is it connected from a place of understanding, a place of clarity, or of confusion? I think it's so helpful to notice that, especially as we kind of, sometimes it is hard in the midst of the fast-pacedness of our lives, especially when we're still kind of in a lot of our normal habit minds, we're still kind of leading a lot. Sometimes it's easy to kind of say something that's not quite true or to lash out in a harmful way. After the fact, we can just reflect on that. You know, we can see feel the impact of that on someone else. We can feel the impact internally. We can start to notice our intention. Was our intention coming from a wise place, from renunciation, from the intention of goodwill, the intention of harmlessness? Or coming from a place of greed or a sense of ill will or of harm? You know, we can see that. We can start to sense that and open to that. The feedback of life is another way that we can learn to be ethical. Like for myself, some of these patterns of mine, so we have kind of the big expressions of the precepts, right? Of killing, of stealing, and sexual misconduct, of lying, of intoxication. But there's also the subtle qualities that are a little bit more ambiguous that I think it's so helpful to also notice. My example I've shared a few times at different settings is years ago, it was years ago now at this point, I noticed that when my family, my wife and my daughter, we were all going to go on a trip, a vacation, I would get a little uptight about that, about leaving on time, making sure everything's packed, everything's set, you know, got to leave right on time. And sometimes I would speak in a harsh way, in a way that wasn't so kind. Kind of like, hurry up, and that kind of thing. We gotta hurry up to have fun together. And luckily, my relationship with my wife and my daughter is such that they are willing to share the impact. You know, so they started to, you know, say that, you know, it's not very fun when you're like that. So I asked, tell me more about that. Tell me more about what that's like for you when I go into that. And I listen to the impact of that, the sense of fear or uncomfortableness. And when I really heard that, without adding shame to myself, without adding guilt, it brought that quality of clarity. It's like, okay, I don't want to act in that way. I don't want to change. I don't want to continue to cause harm in that kind of unconscious way. And so then I was able to start to change that pattern. That's like, okay, it's all right if we miss the ferry. It's okay if we do this a little later. It's not that big of a deal. And at first it was a little, they were a little bit disconcerting, you know, it was a little, not so much disconcerting, but a little disorienting, because, okay, why aren't you keeping track of the time? You know, so there's that change of a relationship. But that's one of the feedbacks we can get from life, is when we have people, we have impact on someone else through our actions, instead of adding a sense of guilt and remorse that makes us collapse more and more to that painful sense of self, just listen to it. Listen to the feedback. You know, so much of what we want is to be heard, to be actually met in that. A book I read years ago around, it was by a medical physician, but one of the things he talked about, he felt a lot of malpractice was really much more those suits. Litigation was really more about a breakdown of relationship, a breakdown of communication. And when he felt like if you just connected with patients, a lot of those filled away. You know, so that sense of listening, really taking it in, listening to what the impact of your actions have been, and learning from that, And meditation, again, gives you this capacity just to learn those lessons, learning them, how is the body feeling in those moments, how does the mind distort the world, how does the mind order the world based on that pattern, which is really flowing from greed or hatred or delusion. And by doing that, you start to become more and more clear. You start to see more and more clearly how your actions are. And that starts to lead to that quality of joy, that quality of bliss, the bliss of blamelessness. You know that you're living a life, you're connecting. Of course, as humans, we're going to fall down, we're going to fail. But how do we pick ourselves up? How do we try to live in a better way? Now, some of us, you know, have in the past done things which we realize were not so skillful, that perhaps caused some significant harm to someone else, close to us, distance from us. As we reflect on that, I think it's helpful to do that in a skillful way. Okay, I think what's not so skillful is to use that to kind of amplify and re-engage that sense of guilt, that sense of shame. Reflect with compassion that often, even if we're being very unskillful in our past, in some ways we're doing the best we could in that moment. Perhaps that was the only option that we could have access to in that moment. Connecting with the pain that may have driven us to that place of action, the place of hurt or the sense of inadequacy, the sense of insufficiency, maybe the seeking of some kind of pleasure, and how that led to us to acting in a way that's unethical. So as you open to that, bring that quality of forgiveness, that self-forgiveness to those past actions. Because if we really judge ourselves for our past actions, it's going to be hard for us to open to the reality in the future. You know, how our actions may harm someone. Like, I'm going to just judge myself. I'm already doing that so much. I'm going to hide that away. If I can learn to open and say, okay, I messed up there. I can understand the pattern that arose. I can understand the intention behind it. I can have this commitment not to act again. Then we become much more safe to ourselves. We're able to listen more and more deeply to ourselves. So ethics are such a rich topic of how to explore it, how to integrate it in our lives, you know, start to notice the quality that of pleasure that comes from, there is a pleasure that sometimes comes from being unethical, if we're honest with ourselves, right? It's a short-term pleasure, perhaps, like I'm going to steal that extra cookie or take something which isn't really mine. There's that thrill, perhaps, that happens. But there's also this longer-term cost, this longer-term pressure that builds up that we don't always acknowledge. And when we are ethical, we can start to really rejoice in that, rejoice in that clarity, rejoice in that sense of blamelessness. And what's interesting about ethics, too, especially in this tradition, we're not big about like the Ten Commandments. We don't have like a set of Buddhist Ten Commandments. We have the precepts, but those are also phrases to refrain from, to undertake the training to refrain from. And it's really up to us to integrate that, to see that, and have discernment about when we have to kind of work around this. Like the first precept of non-harm, of killing, non-killing. When I was really new in the practice, I'm very gung-ho. I wanted to follow this precept, and I had this situation at my home with a wasp nest. Right? I wanted to get rid of the wasp nest because I didn't want my young child and her friends to get stung. But I wanted to honor this precept. So what I did is I put I knocked the nest down and ran away really quickly, so kind of minimizing how much harm was caused. But the wasps really liked that spot of the branch, so they built the nest again. It's kind of amazed how quickly they rebuilt it. So the next thing I thought, okay, well, I'll do a catch and release. So I put a garbage bag underneath this, or a garbage can, knocked the nest down, covered it up, somehow without getting stung, took it to a deserted part of the park and released it and ran away. Right, I'm not recommending this. I'm just showing the lack of discernment. But, you know, it's thrilled as that interest of wanting to be not harmed. And they still came back. They built it again. And then finally I got the insecticide. But it was interesting how not making that the first choice transformed that act of killing in that case. It came from a place of heaviness, of sorrow, of grief. You know, I could see the necessity, but yet, you know, I had to do that. And that's that nuance that we have sometimes choices that we have to kill different things. You know, if we have to get rid of termites or pests or these different things, but to do it with the quality of an open heart. And I think that's a question that came up actually in an email was around pro-choice, pro-life, you know, and how that precept is held around that. And that's, you know, for myself, I really deeply feel that women should have their own right to choose. They have the choice over their own body, whether to have a baby or not. And I would encourage us to really feel that, to feel the impact of that choice, to feel, yeah, this is this grief around taking a life. And it may be the very best thing to do. And it's just one of those nuances there that I really appreciate this practice. We don't have some external authority defining what's ethical and what's not. There's so much encouragement for us to see for ourselves, to really see in a deep way. You know, get feedback from external sources of how your actions are. If you're kind of being a little secretive around something, sometimes just, it's not really confess it, but just share it and say, you know, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? You know, and people might say, yeah, that sounds a little unethical. That sounds a little off. Or they might say, oh, that sounds good. That's such a helpful thing to do. All right, I think that's enough talking for myself. Let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, then I'll talk about the homework. All right, so the homework, hopefully you're able to get a copy or get a picture of it and online. I threw it in the chat, so it should be there for you. But it's pretty simple. Start to notice the pleasure and joy that arises from the choices to be ethical or not, right? The pleasure and joy of both being ethical. And also, there is pleasure for sometimes not being ethical. If it had no drawback, if it had no pleasure in it, we wouldn't be unethical, right? We wouldn't follow that. It's like if we picked up a hot stone and it burned our hand, we wouldn't keep picking it up. But often we don't really acknowledge that pleasure of it, or we're so busy feeling guilty, we don't even see that. And just notice that, okay, there's a little pleasure for stealing something, or for saying an untruth, or something like that. Just to be honest, that sense of opening to this whole capacity at being human. Okay, opening and seeing is different than acting from, right? We can see and open to very clearly, and then that from that point we have a choice of whether we follow that or not. So notice the pleasure and joy that arises around the choices to be ethical or not be ethical. What pleasure is short-term based on conditions? What sense of pleasure or joy is long-term based on actions, based on the choices we make? And what is the role of internal versus external motivation around ethics? You start to play with that a little bit. You know, when you have this choice point of being ethical, meditation lets us pay more and more clear attention. That choice point arises, am I going to be ethical or not ethical? Notice what's motivating that, right? So part of it is I'm asking us just to step back and notice what's driving our behavior. The more clear we can become of that, the more we can actually become free of it or deepen into it, right? Am I being motivated by fear of punishment? Or am I motivated because I want so-and-so to think I'm an ethical person? Am I going from that sense of internal motivation? That internal alignment is more and more important. All right, so play with that. Bring more energy around ethics this week. Those two choice points of pleasure, long-term, short-term, conditions, actions, and what's the role of internal versus external motivation around ethics. I'll offer a recap talk next week, and then we'll have a chance for some small group discussions. But now we have a chance for any questions you might have around ethics, around this exploration. Yes, do you mind grabbing the mic so they can hear you online?
Thanks very much, Tim. I remember being part of a discussion once that looked at sort of the concept of ethical monotheism. That's the commandments, for example,
yes,
versus what we're talking about, which is allowing an understanding, and that Bill gives a little bit more nuance. But the question that came up is there are societies historically and even in the present moment where kids, for example, are taught to hate another group of people to the point that it's an act of good behavior to harm those people. I think the example of Nazi Germany, where the people killing Jews actually felt they were eliminating this sickness from their society. So without a solid boundary like a Ten Commandment, the internal compass can be deflected. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting reflection. I'm curious what
you
think.
Sure. Well, yeah, they can have the external authority saying here's a hard boundary.
You cannot kill. Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, you can have an external authority saying it's okay to do that. You know, like the Khmer Rouge. I mean, there's so many examples of that, how some external authority encouraged people to do things which were based in non-harm. So it's kind of like we have to, and yet we can look at those examples and we can also see people who knew it was unethical, that it was like it was hurting their hearts to do that. And they found some way to avoid doing that or helping where they could. So that's really an excellent example of how the external authority by itself isn't enough. It's like that internal authority really helps to safeguard. And sometimes our internal authority is kind of off, right? We've kind of got, maybe we learned a certain pattern of racism or a pattern of prejudice or pattern of hatred that we've internalized as being true. So having that external willingness to hear. So for me, a lot of it just comes down to that interconnection. You know, am I connecting to someone else? Am I connecting to them? And even when we have to draw boundaries or have a sense of safety around it, again, Sylvia Bordstein, who I think said that line about we can't get away with anything, I think she also said, you might throw someone out of your life, but not out of your heart. So it's coming from that place of heart connection.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. It reminds me of another story. Sharon Salzberg was traveling, you know, she was a student back in Asia, and traveling by the rickshaw drivers, and a drunk tried to pull her off and, you know, assault her, and she was able to escape, and she was telling her teacher about that, and he sensed that she was a little too passive around that because she was trying to you know, not cause harm. And he said, with all the loving kindness in your heart, hit him over the head with your umbrella. Right? So that's this dance of ethics. Okay, what else? Go ahead, Judith.
So today I was listening to a talk by Joseph Goldstein, and he was talking about guilt, and he said something that really struck me. He was talking about a time when he'd done something unskillful, and he was fretting about it and everything and trying to use meditation. And he said it suddenly occurred to him that guilt was an ego trip, that it actually was strengthening the sense of self, that it was almost like kind of self-indulgent. Mm-hmm. And then he made a distinction between guilt and remorse. So he said his solution was that he came to a sense of remorse over what he'd done, but somehow got rid of the guilt. So I was wondering what you thought of that.
No, I think that's, I haven't heard that talk, but I can hear Joseph saying that, and you know, how he's, you know, sincerely practicing something until he kind of saw the suffering and the way he was actually relating to it. And I think that's a beautiful statement, that guilt is really an ego trip. Because we think of ego almost as that, you know, look how great I am. But the ego is just as activated when we're like, look how bad I am. Or look, that reinforcement of that. And absolutely, that is really, it's a powerful way to reinforce that sense of self. I think that's something that many of us, when we try to work with our guilt and our remorse or just our self-hatred, that we forget that it actually serves us because it reinforces that sense of self. You know, we forget that sense of self is kind of a big thing of what that does. And then it becomes a different way of working with it. Instead of trying to get over my guilt around it or my, you know, have that sense of self-love, it's more realizing, oh, I'm kind of reforming myself. I'm reintegrating myself. And how that in itself is keeping this suffering cycle going. Now, remorse, I think that's a great reframing of it. It's like a reflection with discernment, with wisdom, with compassion upon our actions. It's like, oh yeah, there's a lot of remorse that I did that action. And yet, you know, I can't go back and change it. You know, that's already happened. But that remorse allows us to learn how to recognize what was motivating us, what was causing it to happen, and seeing if we can not allow that to arise, or if it arises, we'll be much more awake to that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Let's see, I saw Bob threw something in. What about shame? Isn't that guilt imposed from without? Yeah, shame. Yeah, I think shame is often, yeah, is an external motivator, like, you know, shame on you, or you should feel ashamed of yourself. Yeah, it's this external quality that perhaps that's how we learned it, but I think we can also internalize it too. It can be that sense of deep something fundamentally wrong with who I am and what I am. All right, what else? Yes, come on up.
Thanks, Tim. I think I don't fully understand why it feels good to be ethical. In my mind, you know, ethics come to be because we need a way to function in society. Yes. It's kind of a feedback loop that tells you how to exist with, you know, the people and the environment you're in. But I'm not sure I understand why it inherently feels good to be ethical.
And that, so why does it feel good to be ethical, you know, versus just having it as a set of rules to allow us to get along with each other? Well, you know, for myself, I'll just speak from my own experience, my own exploration around it. When there's a sense of, let's say when I'm not ethical, there's kind of a tension that comes up, right? There's a kind of a friction. Even if, you know, even if there wasn't any kind of external rules around it, if I knew I was causing harm to someone, there's a way that I have to kind of make them really the other and discount their needs, discount their validity to be alive or to have their own needs met. There's a way of kind of makes it make sense. But there's a way that creates this, it kind of amplifies a sense of separation, right? When I'm ethical, it's affirming the sense of connection, that sense of interrelationship. It's a sense of almost like honoring someone to be, okay, you can have your own life, your own body here, your own possessions, that I'm not going to intrude upon that. It's almost affirming their integrity, their wholeness. And by doing that, I have to come from a place of wholeness myself, right? It's hard to come from a place of kind of diminishment and say, okay, you're okay. It's not quite that same flavor of that. But when there's a quality of a really coming from an integritous place myself, that sense of wholeness and acknowledging someone else's wholeness, and beauty and integrity and all that, there's a way that kind of reflects back and forth. I'm also acknowledging that. So that's one of the reasons. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I think that makes sense. I think what that brings to mind for me, though, is if you think you're acting ethically, but your ethical code is different from whomever you're interacting with, or maybe your viewpoint of the world is bounded. So you think you're acting ethically, but you've actually done something to harm someone else. And so I think in that case, it's confusing to me, because in acting ethically, you could have ignorance as bliss, where you feel good about yourself, despite missing some broader impact that you're having.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure how to deal with that.
Well, yeah, I would say ethics don't operate in a vacuum, right? They operate in relationships, that sense of feedback. Because an action that's ethical, you can almost define it that based on how the other person receives it, right? They receive it in a way that they feel, okay, they're not being put out, they're not being harmed, then that kind of completes that circuit. But if I'm acting in a way that's not, you know, it feels ethical to myself, but it's not actually, it's a little distorted, it's a little bit off, the other person's going to reflect that if I'm sensitive to that, if I'm willing to listen to that. And that's, I mean, you can see this in interpersonal relationships, because often the other person, you both feel comfortable enough kind of sharing stuff, right? Sharing when things aren't going well. And I mean, how often have you found that you, maybe your significant other is giving you some feedback and you're like, no, I'm not like that, or that's not, you kind of discount it. But if you let that in after a while, it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, I see your point now. You know, so eventually you kind of get to that. But I think it is essential to have that that willingness to listen and to kind of perceive how is this landing in the other person. Because you're absolutely right. We have different blinders. We have different relative scales of what's ethical and what's not ethical. You know, there's a set of ethics with a group of thieves, for example. There's a code of behavior, perhaps, that they steal from these people, not from other people. There's a kind of an integrity to that. But you bump up against it, you know, it doesn't fit. So I think that's a big part of it, is learning that. Another aspect around it is understanding power differential. You know, what's the difference in power? What's the difference in authority? What's the difference in you know, so many different ways we can define power, whether it's like a teacher and a student. Could be in our culture, there's so much more inherent privilege and power if you're white, for example. You know, and all of those, we have to be aware of that. How our impact may not feel like it's doing a lot, but it can actually have a big impact on someone else. Male, female, there's so many different ways. You know, straight versus gay. You know, there's different ways that those show up. So we have to really be willing to always be alive for it. It's not like we learn our ethics. I think the most successful people with ethics make it an ongoing investigation, an ongoing practice. Right?
Yeah, thank you. I think that makes sense. And you saying being sensitive to how others feel resonates with me. And I would just carry that further to what you just said, where being really sensitive to why I think something that I'm doing is ethical. And that, I think, is the ongoing investigation that you just mentioned. So
yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for sharing that. All right. Anyone else like to ask or share anything? All right, Emery, go ahead.
Hi. I've been thinking about the connection between sila and joy. That was an unexpected, like, connection that you started the talk off with. But what arose for me when I started thinking about those two concepts is the experience of slowing down, and how for me, when I'm in a rush, and moving quickly and thinking quickly, I'm much more likely to act in ways that are not sensitive or not ethical, caring, or just really in line with my true intentions, my highest intentions. And that when I slow down, I can be, you know, much more just have a lot more integrity. And it's also really joyful. Like, that feels really good to be able to slow down and take my time and notice if an impulse comes up to, I don't know, to gossip or to even have like a, you know, judgment or criticism. And there's just such a, for me, there's such a joy in slowing things down, noticing and aligning my words and actions with what my hopes for myself are.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, that slowing down kind of allows us to be the most skillful, to be the most, I like how you said that, really that alignment with our, you know, what we really value allows that to kind of sync up. Kind of related to that, when we're busy and over and rushed, it's easier to be, you know, harsh or harmful and just not as skillful. Also, if we're overwhelmed, right? If we're really depleted, if we're sleep deprived, if we're really under a lot of stress, it's much easier to be, you know, kind of harsh, to be, you know, come out in ways that we're just kind of lashing out. So that's also that kind of feedback that we often think of non-harm as this external thing toward other people. But what if we also fully did it toward ourselves? Can we not harm ourselves through our, you know, overdoing it, or not enough rest, or not enough good diet, or whatever it might be, is to have that sense of caring for ourselves equally. So it starts to, you know, ideally blur together that internal ethics, including how much time we give ourselves, the pace of our lives, our self-care, that all benefits us, but also allows us to then benefit others. Thank you, Emery.
Yeah, I have the image of like an ecosystem, like a very delicate ecosystem, and everything is connected, so that our internal, pace, self-care, number of responsibilities we take on, there's no like virtue in overdoing it or overcommitting or rushing around, taking too much on. It actually, in the grand connection, in the grand ecosystem, it causes harm. So yeah, thank you for this talk and for that.
You're welcome. Yeah, that balance, that interrelationship of all the, you know, all those pieces. And also when we, you know, we are tired, when we're rushed, when we're overworked, just realize, okay, that's a good time to be extra attentive, you know, extra, a little more attentiveness of how I'm acting, where that action's coming from. All right, what else is out there? Yeah, Austin, you mind grabbing the mic so they can hear you online?
Very quickly, just, you know, I thought about, you know, if you have to fart during a meditation, and it may feel joyful to just let it go, but you're around other people, and you don't want to rob from them the ability to breathe during the meditation. So just going back to the moral ambiguity. No, that was a joke. But the thing I wanted to say quickly was I appreciate the first and second order thinking. I don't know if you're familiar with this concept. So first order thinking is, you know, you make me really angry, so it feels good to lash out and kill you. Second order thinking is, well, if I kill you, I'm going to go to prison the rest of my life. Mm. And sometimes we don't think about in our actions the second order effects of the things that we do. And what I like about Sila is, and the way I'm starting to understand all of the precepts, in some ways they're helping us to think in a second order way about the impacts of our actions, cause and effect, and karma. So I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but it became alive for me thinking about one of the questions asked here was, you know, what's inherently joyful about the precepts and taking these right actions? And one of what struck me was, well, you avoid these second order impacts that might not seem immediately obvious, right. But upon more introspection, you can see why stealing or some of the other precepts might not be so good in the end.
That's right. Yeah, the second order and thinking, the consequences of our actions, and that's another, you can look at all these different powerful ways for us to be more ethical, and that reflection, that pausing, realizing there's this impulse I want to do something that's going to cause harm, but if I can pause and notice, okay, what's going to come back at me? What's going to be the secondary or the consequence of that action is so essential. It's interesting, in our culture, we use the word karma kind of in lots of different ways. But karma, you know, literally just from a Pali perspective or Pali language perspective means action, right? But it's action that we put our intention behind. We put our energy into it, whether we're using our bodies, our mouths, or our minds. But that carries a certain potential, right? There's this karmic fruit that we're planting. And sometimes it may not be direct. You know, maybe I completely got rid of that, but then it comes back, you know, to get us in a different way. There's a different thing that arises. Also, there's the positive karma, too. It's like if we act in a kind, generous way or a place from integrity, that also has a certain echo that comes back at us. It's kind of like what we've been talking about all along, is that sense of listening and that feedback. There's the immediacy of my action, how that's received. There's also the more the longer term or the maybe, you know, more indirect coming back. Yeah. Yeah, that's a nice way to think about that. That secondary action or secondary thoughts. All right, anyone else? Yes, do you mind coming up?
So, one of the things you talked about is as a motivation, is the desire to be blameless or the joy of being blameless. And that was really interesting for me because it's such a powerful driving force. I think we all have it. But I also thought about how it can lead to drastically different outcomes. You know, maybe you will do the right thing, you know what the right thing is, but like you have to be very wise or free of kind of delusions in order to do the right thing. Like if you want to be blameless in your story, you could have yelled at your wife and told her that it's all her fault that she's late, and then you would have felt blameless. You know, so it takes more than just the desire to be blameless.
That's right.
And so I've been kind of struggling to kind of, like, to me there seems to be like this really deep and complicated element of wisdom in ethics. And that's the part that I feel like some of the other questions have also touched upon, with the second order thinking and kind of like how ethics isn't, you know, like it, to me it feels like it has to come from somewhere inside, from this wisdom, but, you know.
Right. That wisdom is really an integral part to ethics and how that grows. And it's also something that we learn over time. You know, we have learned it through bad choices, bad, you know, actions. Like I heard this joke that good judgment comes from experience and experience comes from bad judgment. Right? So we do things and we recognize that. But yeah, it's true, we can stay, and that's kind of the honesty, like what Judith was speaking with Joseph's reflection around shame versus remorse. Is like we start to get a sense, we start to kind of monitor how strongly am I loading up this sense of me, right? So if I'm feeling like I'm blameless because I'm projecting, I'm not taking any responsibility, I'm projecting it everyone else, it's all their fault. Yeah, I may claim that I'm blameless, but I'm also really solidifying that sense of me, that sense of solidity of who and what I am is so strong in that. Well, if we're able to release that and really let that blamelessness kind of appear because of the kind of the feedback from life, the feedback from others, instead of something I claim, it's something that's really, it's really coming from, okay, that action really didn't cause harm. You know, to take that in, to let that come in. You can notice how the sense of me is not so solid in that. And that becomes a really helpful guidepost as our practice matures, is how more solid am I? As a teacher, I'm often, you know, depending on what kind of question it is or what I'm working with the student, I'm often noticing how solid are they making themselves in relationship to it. You know, and if they're ripe for it, sometimes you can point that out. And maybe try being less solid, maybe less invested in that. And that's interesting because, you know, there's this internal authority, external authority. This is ethical, not ethical. When we start to really integrate ourselves, our heart just kind of knows. It's like the heart, it has this clarity. That's the wisdom. It's not so much from our minds. Because as another person talked about, is that you can have this external authority defining ethical behavior that's really not ethical. But our heart knows. Our heart knows when we're connected, when we're disconnected.
Thank you very much. When I first started coming here about a year ago, my biggest kind of pushback instinctively was from all the talk about solid and non-solid self. Mm. Like, but I am finally warming up to it and realizing it makes sense. So thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, that solid, not solid self is such a integral part of the practice, and it's also something we kind of feel into and start to see for ourselves. And basically, we start to connect with that suffering from that place is what causes this extra suffering.